So, good morning.
I am Erhan Kudeki. And this is ECE 329, Fields and Ways number 1. Okay? And my office is 153 Everett Flat. And I'll have 2 office hours per week. I think Tuesdays and Mondays and Wednesdays at 4 o'clock. Because we are going to have 2 homeworks per week. This being a summer session, instead of 1 homework per week, we have 2 homeworks per week. And they will be collected on Tuesday at 5 and then on Thursday at 5. So the day before the homework is due, I'll have my office hours so that you can come and ask questions. Okay, so this is EC 329. It's called Fields and Ways 1. It is a required class for both EEs and COMPEs, and it is the first half of a pair of courses. There is a Fields and Ways number 2, and do you guys know what number that is? 350, which is not a required course, but it's a semi-required course for EEs at least. Okay? When you go through both 329 and 350, you go through a complete first pass of the treatment of what you need to know from topics of electricity and magnetism, electromagnetism, as applicable for electrical and computer engineering. The second course is semi-required because we have to make compromises. It's very tough to teach electrical engineering in 4 years. We have a very fresh and vivid topic that is growing every year. People are making new inventions, so electrical engineering is becoming, you know, full of more and more materials to learn. And we have to always teach you this thing within 4 years. It's tough, okay? So we go through adjusting our curriculum every so often, trying to get the right balance between the fundamentals and also new applications and so forth, but we have to make compromises. So ideally, we would like all ECEs, electrical and computer engineers, to have Fields and Ways 1 and then Fields and Ways 2, but the compromise is that if you want to focus on some other things, number 2, 350, is another list. It's in this list that we call 3 out of 5. Yeah, so that's our compromise. So ideally, you want to take all those 5 courses in 3 out of 5. But that conflicts with perhaps your desire to specialize in a few topics that you dearly love, and then that's our compromise. That's the short summary. And what we're going to cover is on my t-shirt. All right. So my t-shirt tells what's our point in these 2 courses, and I'll get to that soon. Okay. I'll be using various tools as I teach this class. It's gonna be a combination of my class notes projected over there somewhere, as well as I will use the blackboard, and I will be going back and forth so you don't get bored. I noticed that if you use only one of these techniques, it doesn't work as well. In the meanwhile, let me pass this thing here. Please put a check mark next to your name. And so it's a. We care about attendance in this class. Summer classes are weird because you take a normal semester class and compress it in a very short time. Okay? And it's tough for everyone, the teacher, the student, and all that. I guess you are here instead of in a vacation resort site because you decided that you want to take this course. The only way you're going to succeed in this is by really coming to class every day, okay? Attendance becomes even more important because the pace is so fast, okay? If you miss a lecture or two, all of a sudden you find that you can't follow things. So attendance is very important. I taught exactly this class in this room last year, this time, and I had tremendous attendance, much better attendance than during normal semesters. Students cared about it, and they did fine. They did well in that class. Okay, so I hope to see a similar sort of enthusiasm, if you will, so that we can take advantage of this summer time slot and really make progress, get this required course out of the way. I'm not going to ask why you're taking this course in the summer. You must have a good reason. Okay. So let's see. Where is my favorite browser? This is my favorite browser. And let's go to EC329. So now we go to the course page. And there it is. Okay, so I didn't give you, please find a seat somewhere and sit down. So I didn't bring you a flyer about the course because all there in our website, you can Google it, EC329, it takes you right there. And here's some information, let's go through it quickly. I am Erhan Kudeki, as I indicated, and office hours, it says Monday, Thursday, 4 p.m., I said Wednesday, so I'm a little bit confused. Homeworks, I guess we are getting on Tuesdays and Fridays, not Thursdays, that's why. My office hours are on Mondays and Thursdays at 4 o'clock in Everett 153, because homeworks will be collected on Tuesdays and Fridays. All right, we have our first homework that's already sitting there waiting for you, and if you want to find it out, you go here and you click there, okay? And I have to show that I'm a legit person here. And that's homework number one. And June 14, is June 14 Thursday or Friday? It's Thursday, so that's a mistake, okay? That's my first mistake in this class. That should be June 15, okay? And this homework is sort of based on stuff that you should know how to do anyways, even if you haven't taken this course. It doesn't really depend on the material in this course. It's sort of related to it, but it really depends on three courses of utmost importance for this course, and they are Physics 212. In Physics 212, you were exposed to electricity and magnetism, to Maxwell's equations. These equations, written in a slightly different form, in integral form rather than the differential form that you see here. Okay, so you know what an electric field is, you know what magnetic field is, sort of, but these are tough concepts. It takes a while to really get used to it. So here's another opportunity. You see, 329 is an opportunity to sort of like even get better understanding of what these things are from the perspective of electrical engineers rather than physicists, okay? So 212, therefore, is very important. The other important class is the class where you learn vector calculus. Which class was that? Matt? 241, indeed. That was a four-hour class. The add-on part was vector calculus. What did you learn in that vector calculus? Do you remember specific names that you can correlate with that portion of the course? Divergence, curl. Divergence, gradients, curls. Okay, you see divergence, gradients, divergence and curls on this in these equations, okay? What else did you learn in that part of that course? You learned about integral formulation. You had fluxes, surface integrals over surfaces enclosing volumes, and then relationship between certain quantities integrated over the surface and certain quantities integrated over the volume that is enclosed. Okay? So divergence theorem, curl theorem, Stokes theorem, stuff like that. Those are relevant in going back and forth between these forms of Maxwell's equations and the sort of Maxwell's equations that you learn in Physics 212. One of the Maxwell's equations you learned in Physics 212 was Gauss's law. Do you guys remember Gauss's law? What was it about? It was sort of like the surface integral over a closed surface of an electric field equals the charge contained divided by epsilon naught, something like that, right? Okay, so that was a fundamental law of nature. It governed how charges produce electric fields, okay? But electric fields only by themselves do not sort of describe the entire electromagnetic phenomenon. Magnetic fields also have to be taken into account. In fact, if you observe the dynamics of charged particles experimentally, after a while you come to the conclusion that these charged particles experience some sort of a force, and that is what we call the Lorentz force. If I write Lorentz force, F is equal to the charge of the particle times E plus V cross B. And this V is the vector velocity of the charged particle in the observation reference frame. In the lab, charge is moving with some velocity V. And then it is going to obtain, it's going to sort of like exhibit some force acted upon it. And how do we sort of like get the gist of that there is force applied on a particle? If there is a force, there is a corresponding? Say, F equals? Ma. Yeah, there's going to be a corresponding acceleration. So if you see a charge accelerating, you have to say there is a force, and forget about gravity, things that will accelerate a charge with charge Q are the electric field and the magnetic fields that are at the locations where the charge is at a given instant. Okay? So in a sense then, operationally speaking, electric field is force per unit charge if the charge itself is not moving. If a charge in the lab has zero velocity and experiences a certain amount of force, then the force per charge is the definition, operational definition of the electric field on that charge. Okay, but that room may not only have where the charge is, not only have electric field, but also magnetic field. But, and you would know that there is a magnetic field by making observation of the acceleration of this charge when that charge is moving in your reference frame. Okay, and that you would pick up information about the speed. Is there a magnetic field in this room? Where is it coming from? There's all sorts of magnetic fields in this room to begin with. They are coming from all sources of lights and radio waves, radio stations and all that. There's a whole bunch of time-varying magnetic fields crisscrossing this room, as well as electric fields associated with them crisscrossing the room. And those are related through these equations. These are wave equations that you derive from these equations, okay? And these equations are the wave equations for traveling waves in vacuum, okay? So we know that more or less between sun and earth there is vacuum. That's not quite true. There is some solar wind, etc. But nevertheless, it's almost like vacuum, and light propagates through this region. And it propagates by obeying these equations, okay? So Maxwell's equations have time-varying solutions that we call waves. They also have stationary solutions that are not changing with time if the sources of these electric and magnetic fields are not changing in time themselves. And what are the sources of the electric and magnetic fields, one at a time? What is the most basic source of electric fields? Whatever was the subject matter of Gauss's law that we quickly reviewed. What was it? Charge. Electric charge produces electric fields. Okay? Actually, a more general thing you can say is, for some weird reason, our universe works the following way. There are charged particles, and they interact with one another, okay? When they are even stationary, they interact with one another, and then when they are moving, they interact in even more complex ways. Okay, so how are we gonna handle these interactions? It turns out the best way of handling those interactions mathematically is to invent this concept of fields, okay? So fields are then generated as a sort of a mathematical help. Charges generate fields, and then those fields accelerate those charges. This is the way we talk about the interaction of charges with other charges far away, okay? And then the electrical engineers take advantage of this weird thing, okay? They build devices so that we have our cell phones, we can talk to our friends or whatever, okay? So there is an incredible thing that I have in my pocket. It's a radio station. Okay, it all works on the principles that we are talking about. Also, the simple circuit theory that we learn in ECE 110 and 210, okay, they are related. Those topics are related to exactly this stuff. In fact, regular circuit theory of ECE 210, lump circuit analysis, is nothing other than an approximation to the simplest situation that is associated with these equations. Okay? If the charges are not moving at all, this equation collapses to statics equation. There is electrostatics and magnetostatics. These are things that you sort of studied actually in physics 212. You can find the electric field due to static charges, and you can find the magnetic field due to static. Say, what generates the magnetic fields? Say it. Currents. Okay, so if current is changing as a function of time, then it will create a magnetic field that is also changing as a function of time. But if the current is not changing as a function of time, it will generate a static field. Sort of hard to imagine a current that is not changing as a function of time, because current is associated with the motion of charges. But you can still have static currents. You can have a current loop that is carrying the same current forever, and that will generate a static magnetic field. Okay? But if the current in that loop is changing as a function of time, that magnetic field is going to be changing as a function of time. Okay? It turns out that if the sort of like the motions of the charges that generate the electric fields is slow enough, or if the time variation of the current in a loop that is generating a static magnetic field is slow enough, then the formulas that you have for expressing the magnetic and electric fields in terms of the currents and charges coming from statics, they can still be used in time-varying situations to under certain limitations. And those are said to be the quasi-static situations. Okay, so ECE 110 and 210 gave you lump circuit analysis that was based on quasi-static interpretation of these equations. Okay, but the condition for quasi-static situation to be valid and not be very erroneous is that the circuit must be small. If the circuit is large, then using quasi-static solutions and basing a circuit theory on them is wrong. Okay, and so only for small circuits, the circuits rules that you have learned in ECE 210 applies. Okay? In this course, the last one third of this course is extending the circuit theory of ECE 210 into distributed circuit theory, in which all the terms here, time-varying aspects are also important. And that is, in practice, for electrical engineers, the topic of transmission lines. If you take the counterpart of this course in physics, you will learn a lot of the same things. You will learn about Maxwell's equations, electrodynamics, and so forth. But still, the coverage is not going to be identical. Physicists emphasize certain things. Electrical engineers emphasize slightly different things. We emphasize transmission lines. Transmission lines is something that you would not see in the physics counterpart, because transmission lines is nothing but an extended version of the surface that you started to learn in 110 and then 210. Okay, so I was also talking about what? Three courses that are important for this course. I went through two of them. It was physics 212, and the next one was math 241. And what is the third one? Obviously, ECE 210. ECE 210 gave you the lump circuit basics, as well as linear theory tools. And you have learned about transforms and a lot of applied calculus, right? Fourier transforms, Laplace transform, frequency domain versus time domain. You know, you can solve some problems better in the frequency domain, others in time domain, and you learn the link between the two, convolution, okay? All those things, and you learn about weird things called delta functions or the impulses. All those things are also going to make their appearances in this course. We will rely heavily on ECE 210 stuff in this course. That's why it's a mistake for a student to take this course and ECE 210 at the same time. You shouldn't be doing that, unless you've seen this stuff somewhere else. You're a transfer student or something, you can hack it. But if that's not the case, this course has to follow ECE 210. Any questions? All right. So the homework is then due Friday. This is basically a review of stuff that you know from these three courses, various ways. The first problem is just boring vector operations. We define a few vectors in Cartesian coordinates, and then we ask you to add them, subtract them, take their magnitudes, take their dot products, and take their cross products. You learn all these things in your math courses earlier, if not even in high school. Even in high school, you've seen some of this stuff. All right? Etc. This is not a hard homework, so you should start right away. Let's go back to our website. What's the structure of the course? Well, we're going to have three exams. Okay? And then we're going to have a final. So that in that fashion is just like the regular semester. Okay? In each exam, I will ask you three questions. And roughly 50% of those questions are going to come from the homework problems that you will be doing. This is just to motivate you to do homework. Without doing the homework, you're not going to learn this. Okay? And then you will be rewarded by doing the homework when you take the exam. The first exam is going to come roughly 2.5 weeks from now. Then every other 2 weeks, there will be another exam. That's how we're going to get into the August time frame and finish this course. Any questions about this? Homework. No. Exams. They amount to... Now I have my directions messed up because I use Mac Lion and scrolling goes the other direction. So when I go to other computers, it's all wrong. All right, so here we go. Mid-semester, we have three exams. They amount to 60%. So 20% each exam contributing to your final grade. Final exam, 25%. And the homework plus class participation is 15%. Okay? So by doing the homework, you gain all the points that you can get for that 15%. And then by not showing up in the class, you lose points. Okay? So come to class. And also participate in class. We should have discussion. People should ask questions and so forth. So that's the way the score should go. All right, so that's the grading. And let's see, what else? Then we have all these other links here on the top. We have a, let's go to course calendar. Course calendar is telling us when the exams are happening, what topics we are covering every lecture, and there are links to my class notes, okay? So, next lecture, we're going to do Coulomb's and Gauss's laws. And there it is, okay? Coming before the next lecture, please come and please go there and read this. It's all more or less review, but right from the beginning, we also start telling you some new stuff. It's mostly a review of Physics 212, but we also tell you new stuff. The new stuff is really this version of Maxwell's equations. They start coming into picture. Okay? Okay, thank you. All right. So that's the way things are. There are all my lecture notes are here. So there is also this book by Professor Rao that is accompanying my class notes. That book should be used for extra reading. Okay? The order of the class doesn't follow the order in that book. But all the topics that we covered will have simple versions of it somewhere in that book cover. Okay? Students always sometimes want to see a different perspective. That book gives you a different perspective. But you have to do selective reading as that is going on, as you are following that. Wake up. Okay? So you will follow my notes mostly. Okay? But you can read Rao's book. And then if you say, hey, I'm still not satisfied, can you... recommend some other book, I'll recommend you some other books for reading. Okay? Most of the time, students are happy to see a very closely related set of notes associated with a given course, and that's what we are doing here. Okay, so looking at the schedule, let's look at this exam number one on June 27. And the material until exam number one is more or less a study of static solutions of these equations, okay? More or less electrostatics, magnetostatics, and learning about divs and curls and whatnot, and also gradients, okay? So it's a little bit math, a little bit of static electricity and magnetism related to your 241 and Physics 212 material, plus, because we are adding some layers of new materials. And then, after exam one, in that interval from exam one to exam two, okay, we move beyond statics. We get into the full dynamic situation. We have time-varying charges, charges here and there. They are moving from here to there. As charges are moving from here to there, they constitute currents flowing along the line. Okay, so we have time-varying charges and currents, and they generate dynamic electromagnetic fields. Still, a test particle would obey Lorentz law. All right. Whatever is the instantaneous electric field at the location of the charge, plus the instantaneous magnetic field at the location of the charge, taking into account the velocity of the charge in the reference frame where E and B are defined, we can use still this equation to get F. And that F is always equated, if we are doing classical electrodynamics, to what Newton prescribes. Mass times accelerations, that would be mdv/dt. So V shows up here, V shows up there. So this is an equation that a physicist would solve in his electrodynamic studies. And we'll do that a little bit too. But our emphasis is not so much electrodynamics, but really how the fields themselves are changing as they are propagating from source regions to destination regions, because such waves carry our information that we impart to those waves. We use these time-varying electromagnetic waves to communicate with one another. So as an electrical engineer, we are more interested in that phenomenon, and that's going to be our stress. So those time-varying fields are then going to be sort of introduced between exam one and exam number two situation. After exam number two, we will look at a few topics, but we will basically move into, we'll get out of the realm of E and B fields occupying the three-dimensional space between a source antenna and a destination antenna, and specialize into something much easier, going from the source to the destination by a pair of wires, but by a pair of wires that are long compared to wavelengths. Okay, if those pairs of wires are very short, the rules that you learn in EC210 apply. You can do circuit analysis that way. But if that wire is longer than a wavelength for the frequency of the source, then what you learn in 210 is not quite right. You have to extend this into the distributed circuits idea of transmission lines that I already have mentioned, and that comes at the end of the semester. And then shortly thereafter comes the final exam. Okay, so that's more or less the topics that we're going to be seeing. First, static electricity and magnetism, then electromagnetic waves in unguided media. These two-wire transmission lines are examples of guided electromagnetic waves. We finish the semester by studying that, and that study extends our lump circuit analysis into distributed circuit analysis, and then that's it. We are not finished. What we have not really looked at in this course very carefully is how electromagnetic waves are generated by time-varying voltages and currents. We sort of will focus on their propagation rather than their generation. Their generation is the very first topic that is attacked in ECE350, and that is the topic of antenna theory, okay? Antennas are pieces of wires on which you maintain time-varying currents, and those time-varying currents generate these electromagnetic waves that just then cross almost any region, including vacuum, okay? But how do you shape that wire into a good antenna is something that electrical engineers care about, okay? The basics of that is the first topic in ECE350. Okay? And then 350 goes into various details. What happens to these waves in material media where there is dispersion, where different frequencies propagate at different velocities and so forth? Okay? Those are very important in practice. So that's another topic covered in 350. Okay? And then you go into guided waves once again in 350. But in 329, you study guided waves that are guided by pairs of wires, transmission lines, like twin wire is a type of transmission line you have seen. More common transmission line that you have seen laying around in the labs is the coax. You guys know what I mean by a coax? Coax is this inner conductor surrounded by an outer conductor, coax. Okay? Those coaxes are examples of transmission lines that we are going to study in this course. But if you use those coaxes at very high frequencies, they start behaving weirdly. Okay? So when you keep going to higher and higher frequencies, all the stuff that you have learned previously becomes sort of not complete. Okay, we're going to go through that several times, okay? 210 stuff is not quite right if you go to higher frequencies, okay? Then you learn the transmission line 3 in 329, then we correct whatever was the missing part. And then you go to even higher frequencies, then the transmission line theory is still not good enough. There are other types of guided modes that need to be taken into account, and that is treated in ECE 350. So in that way, ECE 350 really takes you in the first class completion of all these topics that you really need to know. Okay? And then 350 itself ends with the topic of antennas now, not for transmitting, but for receiving. These wires that we use as antennas are reciprocal animals. They generate electromagnetic waves from voltages and currents applied to their terminals, but reciprocally, when they are impinged upon by electromagnetic waves, they generate voltages and currents at their terminals that you can now put back into a lump circuit of the ECE210 or ECE110 type. And in that circuit, you might have an amplifier, and then you might have some sort of a down converter, and then a loudspeaker, and then you hear what the electromagnetic wave that you're capturing is carrying. And that's all done, of course, here. Okay, so it's incredible engineering that goes here, and it's all thanks to electrical and computer engineers, and maybe some computer scientists. So we have been transforming this world, really, during the last, many decades. It's never stopping. Like we are living at excited times, and it's exciting to be an electrical engineer or a computer scientist. There's lots of good applications coming up. Any questions? So that's more or less the plan. Now you know you have to go to this calendar, sort of like follow what's going on, and do some reading. Any questions? There are also some little toys here. There are some animations. Let's look at this animation. Okay, this is one of many animations. These animations were written in JavaScript. On your browser, you can look at the code, the JavaScript code, copy it, modify it, and generate your own tools, your own toys. This is a toy that has to do with the static fields generated by three charges. The red dot and the blue dot are two charges, and the plus is the location of yet another charge. Each of these charges are producing Coulomb electric fields, okay? Any stationary charge, point charge, is the source of Coulomb electric fields. Coulomb's law says that, okay? If you're a positive charge, you're going to be sending out electric field vectors in all directions radially, okay? And its magnitude is all going to change. It's going to drop as 1 over distance squared. It's going to blow to infinity at your location, but you don't worry about that, because you worry about the fields at the other charges' locations. And where you are, there's not going to be any other charge, because if you have another charge that is extremely close to you, the name of the game changes. The classical electrodynamics dies out. You have to do things quantum mechanically, and we don't do quantum mechanics in this class. We refer to quantum mechanics once in a while, but you have to take another course for that purpose. Where did you guys see quantum mechanics? Physics? 214. How was that? Did you guys like that class? People are laughing. Quantum mechanics is tough. It's confusing. Okay, so you have to take many, many things. So therefore, we don't say too much about quantum mechanics, except when it is appropriate to make some link. Okay? We will do things classically. So that Coulomb electric field is pointing away from each of these charges. And electric fields point out from positive charges towards negative charges. You have arrows coming in if you are at a negative charge, and arrows going out if you are starting from a positive charge. So the vectors that I have there calculated are the unit vectors associated with the electric field. So the lengths don't indicate the strength of the magnetic fields, but the direction indicates the direction of the static electric fields that are coming from each of these charges. But if you look at this red charge here, I have arrows coming away, so that's a positive charge. If I look at the blue one, arrows are coming in, so that's a negative one. But let's take this plus somewhere far away and pay attention locally. Are the arrows pointing out or in? Well, the way this plot has been made, that arrow is pointing away from the red dot or the purple dot. So it's pointing out, all right? So that is also a positive charge, all right? And the vector field that we are seeing on this plane containing these three charges is the vector superposition of the three charges, three electric fields computed for each charge using Coulomb's law, okay? That's how also the world works, okay? Each stationary charge generates the Coulomb electric fields pointing away from it. And in a region where there are multiple charges, you superpose vectorially the electric fields that are coming from each one of those charges and add them up vectorially. That is the total electric field produced by those three stationary charges. And you see their distributions over here. I can do something weird here. Okay, I'm going to take this plus and put it exactly on top of this minus. If I do it right, basically, even if I don't do it right, you see something nice happening. And almost the entire field over the entire region is becoming dominated by the field coming this red dot. Okay, the radial field coming from red dot is dominating almost everywhere, with the exception of the vicinity of these two charges that are very close to one another. Okay, if I place them exactly correctly, which I can't do because my mouse is not giving me that opportunity, they should cancel out. There it is. Momentarily it happened, right? Okay, I can't do it, but you can do it. There. Almost. I have plus minus charge sitting on top of one another, they cancel one another, and we have only the field that is. So I have plus infinity canceling minus infinity, if you like. You shouldn't be doing that, but that's the way it is. All right? So superposition of fields coming from charges are important. Charges, that's the way the world works. And these equations are linear. Okay? If you look at these equations, they are linear, which means that their solutions can be superposed. If one charge distribution generates one electric field, a second charge distribution generates another electric field governed by these equations, then you can add those two electric fields and the corresponding magnetic fields to correctly come up with the solutions of these equations when both sets of charges are together in space. And that links some of the ideas of this course to the ideas of ECE 210. Because in ECE 210, we learn about linear system theory. Isn't that correct? What was one of the beautiful things that we learned in ECE 210 about linear systems? One of the beautiful things was the fact that the response of a linear system to an arbitrary input can be represented as the convolution of that arbitrary input with one very special function, which was indicated as h of t, and it was called, say, h of t was? Impulse response, yeah. So you take the system, and instead of putting a sinusoid or something else, you put an impulse into that system as the input signal. And what is that impulse? It's sort of a hypothetical thing, but it is a very short and tall pulse. In the limit, the pulse is getting narrower and narrower, and its height is getting higher and higher, preserving the area underneath to be 1. Okay, so that's the impulse. So if you put an impulse into a linear system, the linear system responds with an answer that we call impulse response, h of t. Once you know h of t, then you can take that h of t and convolve with any f of t to get the response of the system to input f of t, right? So this is something that we learn in 210 and we'll be using in this course a lot. Okay, but in ECE 210, we did stuff in time domain. But now we are moving from time domain into space-time domain, okay? We are now going to be in regions where we care about x, y, and z coordinates as well as the t coordinates, okay? So we'll learn how to do convolutions not only in time, but also in space, okay? Is that making sense? So delta of t was an impulse sitting at t equals 0 at whatever t equals 0 our time origin is, okay? But I can also talk of a delta of x. So this lecture, as you are seeing, is a show and tell lecture to give you a broad perspective of what we're going to do. If I scare you by anything I say, don't leave the course because you're scared. Okay? It's normal to be scared a little bit. Okay? It's going to give you some perspective. And then in normal lectures, starting next tomorrow, we will be very disciplined. We'll be doing many examples on the blackboard in the usual sense. Okay? So don't please get scared from what I'm saying here. But delta of x along the x-axis is a spike at x equals 0, okay? So if you have a point charge sitting at the origin, its location can be described, its density can be described by delta of x. Its charge density can be described by q times delta of x. But it's at the origin, it's not only at the zero of the X crossing, but it's also at the zero of the Y crossing and Z crossing. So maybe it will go like this, delta X, delta Y, delta Z times Q. And that would be the charge density. That would tell you there's a charge sitting right at the origin. Okay, so things like this will become possible because of the stuff that we learned in ECE 210 as we move along. Okay, a point charge, of course, is a weird animal. It has no radius. It's just charge sitting there at zero location. That exactly matches this concept of delta function, because delta function has no width. It is in that sense. What is the integral of delta function, delta of t, from t equals minus infinity to plus infinity? One. You remember that, right? So if we were then to take this guy and integrate it from, let's say, x equals minus infinity to infinity, or we don't even have to go minus infinity to infinity, from x equals a minus a to plus a, but also integrate y equals a minus a to plus a, z equals minus a to plus a, and dx dy dz, what happens to each of these delta functions? We apply integration. This is a separable integration. Each of those integrations of the delta functions gives you, tell me, unities. Yeah. Unities. And that would then become equal to, if all the three delta functions integrated in unity, what would come out from this operation? Tell me. This delta of x disappears, this delta of y disappears, this disappears, what happens to q? It doesn't disappear, it stays. So the answer of this is q. So now what we did is took this guy, integrated it over a volume, and ended up with a charge, q, which is measured in charge units of coulombs. Therefore, this guy was charge density, right? If you take charge density, integrate it over a volume, and it gives you the charge, then you have a consistent thing, all right? So then q times the triple delta functions give you the charge density that is associated with a point charge, okay? So we build up our models of static electricity, first starting with lots of point charges sitting here and there, and then we move from that concept into what we call a continuum charge distribution, where we start talking about charge density. We talk about charge density as rho, and this is that rho. Okay? And then if you wonder what is the rho associated with a single point charge, the answer is in terms of delta functions, just the way I have shown. Any questions here? Okay? Another show and tell thing here that may be scaring you a little bit, but there is no reason. You will grow accustomed to this kind of language, and this is the kind of language that you need for your senior year courses when you take them. So we are in our 300 level junior year. This is the transition time where you are now enhancing what you already learned to make you be ready for the real cool stuff that you'll be seeing in your senior year. Any questions here? Okay. So we've seen these tools. There are many other tools that you can look at. I guess that's it. Is there any detail that you want to look at? We have a TA. He's Pablo Reyes. Pablo is somebody that you may know from ECE 210. He was the lab TA there. Very good one. People love Pablo. Pablo told me, hey, I'm sick and tired of doing ECE 210. Let me do something else. So he's a TA of this course. Okay? So then, after the homework is handed, then the solution will appear right here. This will become a link, okay? And study the solutions. Pablo will prepare those solutions. Yes?
Do we ever look at the textbook?
As you were sleeping when I was talking about the textbook.
Oh.
Yes, the textbook is for extra reading, okay? So basically, this is the way you should be doing things. Before you come to a lecture, you sort of like take a glance of the upcoming lecture. All right? You don't have to read it in detail, but quick read. Then come and listen to me, and then go back and see whether you can truly understand what's the stuff there. That may not make every topic clear-cut for you. Then you go and do some extra reading in the textbook. But the order is wrong, so it takes a little bit of an effort. But also, that book is very simple. It's very thin, so it doesn't go into much detail. My notes are much more detailed. You'll find that. Okay? So then, if you're still not satisfied, as I told the rest of the class, but you missed, come and ask me, and I will give you some other reading. All right? So, let's move on. So, these equations. Let me write these equations now. divergence of E is rho over epsilon naught. This rho is charge density. It's Coulomb per meter cube, okay? It can be a continuum, but that continuum is always a macroscopic point of view. Physicists really say that, you know, charges are always collections of discrete charges, all right? But under certain situations, it is okay to go from the reality, which is the microscopic discrete picture, into an average continuum picture, and we will do this a lot, okay? So that, therefore, this rho of t and position, rho is a function, this rho is really a function of all three space coordinates, x, y, and z, which we indicate by the vector r, and t. This animal has to be defined in such a way that if you have a continuum model, it's a continuum function. If you are dealing with a microscopic picture, it represents a collection of discrete charges using delta functions. So we can talk about that. And then this is the electric field. This is also a vector function of all space coordinates and time. Okay? We will mostly work in this class in Cartesian coordinate system, consisting of x, y, and z. Okay? In certain problems, other coordinate systems are better to use. There can be cylindrical coordinate systems or spherical coordinate systems, but most of the problems that we do in this course can be easily handled in Cartesian coordinate system, or they have symmetry that can be exploited not in this form of Maxwell's equations, but the other form that you learn in 212, the integral form. They can be then, without really referencing too much to the details of the spherical or cylindrical coordinate system, they can be done geometrically using those equations, okay? So therefore, we are not going to bother you with the dry stuff that is associated with the handling of spherical and Cartesian coordinate system, because they would be dry in the context of this course. Those things are handled in ECE 350 because in that context they are not dry. When you start studying radiation from antennas, then spherical coordinate system becomes incredibly important because that becomes the natural sort of language to deal with radiation problems. That's when we do spherical coordinates. Okay? And divergence. Do you guys remember how to take divergence from your 241 class? So I have to give you a little bit more details. This electric field vector consists of, in Cartesian coordinate system, three components, E sub x, E sub y, E sub z, correct? So it is really something like this. It's a collection of E sub x, E sub y, and E sub z. Each one of which is a function of x, y, and z, and t. So this guy, E sub x, and likewise E sub y, are four-dimensional functions of four variables, x, y, z, and t. Okay? But then we can group x, y, and z into one parenthesis and call that parenthesis R. Okay, that's R notation. R is a collection of x, y, z. Vector E is a collection of ex, ey, ez. And so these triplets refer to three-dimensional vectors. Our actual vector functions are functions of four variables because time is also added. And sometimes we refer to the collection of x, y, z, t, or r, t, as space-time. Okay? And this is the right way of talking about things. If you do things relativistically, and we'll say a few things about relativity. We'll say a few things about quantum mechanics, not going to details. We'll say a few things about relativity, not going to details, but they are important in some contexts. Any questions here? Okay, so do you guys remember how to take the divergence of electric field from ECE, no, MAT 241? So let me remind you what it was. Okay, you go like this. Do you guys remember it now? Have you seen this? Yes? You're shaking your head. You have seen it.
Yeah.
Okay, so then you there is another language. You say that this is a del operator. This is the ddx, ddy, ddz operator that is dot multiplied with ex, ey, ez. This is what happens. that is equal to rho divided by epsilon naught is the same as this equation. So this is a very compact way, okay? And this equation itself is related to this other form of Gauss. This is Gauss's law, and it is related to this other form that you remember from the physics course. It is E dot ds carried over a surface of an enclosed surface enclosing a volume, and in that volume sits a charge qB divided by epsilon naught. This and this are two different ways of expressing the same fact, Gauss's law. And right now I'm saying it as a statement, but in three days, we will see how this is coming about by in a little bit more detail after I remind you some more details of your math course. Any questions? Okay? So, divergence of E is equal to rho divided by epsilon naught. Divergence of B is equal to zero. Magnetic field has never a divergence because there is no charge that generates magnetic fields. Rho is the charge density, electric charge density that gives birth to electric field. But magnetic fields are not generated by magnetic charges. There are no magnetic charges. Nobody has observed a magnetic monopole. That's what we say. Instead, magnetic fields are generated because of the motions of the charges that give rise to electric fields, okay? And so we need some other equation that helps us with the magnetic field solutions. And let me write those down. There is a linkage between electric and magnetic field, and that is known as Faraday's law. And that is curl of E is equals minus dB dt. Time-varying magnetic field generates a curl for electric field. Now, what is curl? Now, I said that divergence is the dot multiplying of del with electric field. What do you think curl is? You've seen this. Maybe you've forgotten it. But how do you operationally obtain the curl? You cross-multiply that del operator into EX, EY, EZ. And how do you do that? Okay, you do it like this. Cross-multiplication, you can always use determinants in doing cross-multiplication. Okay, so there is the unit vector X, Y, Z, and in this class, we use like this. Maybe in your math class, you had I sub X, I sub Y, I sub C, right? Something like this, unit vectors. So another way of writing this electric field, which I didn't show here, instead of the triplet, you could have written it as E sub X plus unit vector X plus E sub Y times unit vector Y plus E sub Z times unit vector Z. That's another way of writing it. So we have three unit vectors. These are the vectors of length 1 along the X, Y, and Z coordinate system of a Cartesian coordinate system, which, by the way, is right-handed. So we have X-axis, Y-axis, and Z-axis selected such like this, so that when we cross X into Y, our thumb points in the Z direction if we are using our right hand, okay? And when you took the math course and also the corresponding physics course, you had a whole bunch of uses of the right hand rule. So I am now reminding you, we're going to depend on all that. We could have defined a left-handed Cartesian coordinate system, but by agreement, we all work always with right-handed systems, okay? So along the x-axis, if you take a vector that's pointing in that direction of unit length, you have the vector x-hat. Along the y-direction, you have y-hat. Along the z-direction, you have z-hat. And the curl is obtained by writing x-hat, y-hat, z-hat, ddx, ddy, ddz. And on the last, you put e sub x, e sub y, e sub z, and you take the determinant of this. And how do you take the determinant for a three-dimensional 3x3? So you guys probably remember. You take this and multiply this applied to this minus this applied to that, right? And then you add that, holding this minus this. And then lastly, for the y, instead of a plus, you put in front of it a minus. Okay, you know all this stuff. So that's how you do operationally curl, and divergence is easier. And if you are wondering, why do we care about the divergence and curls? There is a Helmholtz theorem that is very profound, and it says, if you know the curl and the divergence of any vector field, it's as good as knowing that vector field. Okay? Have you heard of Helmholtz theorem? from your math course? Yes or no? Probably no, okay? They taught you about divergence and curl, but they really didn't tell you why it is so important to learn about that. It turns out that divergence and curl of any vector field contains all the information that is needed to recreate that field, which is very profound. This is why the Maxwell's equations specify the divergence and curls of E's and B's, and that is by in itself a complete set for you to be able to calculate all the E's and B's that are generated by all rows and J's, and J is the current density. So let me write the last equation that you see here. Curl of B is equal to mu naught times vector J. Current is measured in amperes through a wire, right? Amperes is coulomb per seconds. But if you cut that wire and ask yourself how much current density is there, then you are asking a question of ampere per meter squared, because that wire has a cross-sectional area, and cross-sectional area is measured in terms of meters squared. So amperes per meter squared becomes a current density, and in three-dimensional space you have J, that is the current density, okay? That is a vector because that current can be flowing in this direction or in this direction or in that direction. That distinction can be captured by having a vector. It has a magnitude that in amperes per meter squared gives you how many coulombs per second is passing through meter squared area. That is almost the last equation, but due to Maxwell himself, we have one more term, mu naught epsilon naught dE dt. This is the full set of equations that we have. Now, I ask you, every time, every night, before you go to bed, if you're still awake, to write these equations. If you do this every day for the next month, okay, by the end of this course, you will know these equations. Okay, when you see somebody wearing this t-shirt, say, hey, I know that equation, I know those equations. Not only are in this course are you going to learn these equations, you will learn how to use them, and you will start understanding their implications for everything that we, electrical and computer engineers, care about, design, and build. There are an incredible number of implications, endless, open, infinite number of implications of these things. And a lot of our predecessors have found, some of them have generated the systems that we enjoy today. You can do some more, you can add to it. So that's the real gist of this course. Understand these equations and use them for whatever. Okay, thank you. So read lecture number one notes, which is a little bit long because it has a preface, and then read the second lecture, and I will basically start with the second lecture.